Okay, let's begin the reading of today's Boston Globe on the Talking Information Center for today. It is Thursday, the 19th of February, 2026, and we say hello with the Boston Globe to Mary.
Good morning, John, and welcome all listeners. Today's front page says that neighbors call for city to get tougher on mass and cast. Drug users would be offered detox or face charges, by Chris Serres of the Globe staff. Excuse me. Their patients long since worn thin, residents and businesses near the troubled crossroads of Massachusetts Avenue and Molina Cost Boulevard pressed City Hall on Wednesday to take a much stronger and tougher tack on drug use and homelessness, including deployment of specialized police officers who would direct people into treatment and long-term recovery. The new strategy proposed by the neighborhood and business groups called for ramped up enforcement and expanded outreach in the area known as Mass and Cast by the Boston Police Department, the creation of a specialty court for those arrested for drug crimes, and pressuring of people into treatment. Under the proposal, people found to be using drugs illegally on the streets at Mass and Cast would be offered an ultimatum: either accept placement into drug detox programs or face criminal charges. The proposal, which is supported by a coalition of South End neighborhood groups and several state lawmakers, comes as the Wu administration itself has taken increasingly punitive approaches to conditions at Mass and Cass, a neighborhood long gripped by the overlapping social crisis, homelessness, open-air drug use, untreated mental illness, sex trafficking, and street violence. Last summer, when residents' frustration about outdoor drug use in areas reached a boiling point, city officials ramped up arrests and moved hundreds of people off the street and into inpatient treatment. What we've been doing for the past decade is clearly not working, said Stephen Fox, chairman of the South End Forum, an umbrella organization for the neighborhood groups near Mass and Cass, one of the primary organizations behind the proposal. We need to nudge people into recovery pathways, because leaving them on the streets is not a harmful reduction. Mayor Michelle Wu's office did not directly respond to questions about the group's proposals, though a member of her administration coordinated response team spoke in support at the event on yesterday. But the call for the greater enforcement drew immediate criticism from some public health workers and addiction specialists, who say that intensifying police activity there has already undermined their effort to reach vulnerable people living on the streets. The frequent arrests, they argue, merely contribute to the revolving door. People go into a detox program for a few days or a few weeks and end up back on the streets. Since last fall, groups and nonprofits that provide humanitarian relief to people at Mass and Cass have reported being harassed, yelled at, and told to leave by police officers. The confrontation has turned routine charity at Mass and Cass into a tactical game of cat and mouse with law enforcement, says a profit outreach groups. To evade the police, aid workers say that they are handing out supplies, winter clothes, and overdose reversal drug Narcan from cars instead of venturing out on foot, which undermines their efforts to have meaningful interactions with people in need of addiction treatment and other support services. This is all counterproductive and potentially deadly, said Cassie Hurd, director of Material Aid and Advocacy Program, a Cambridge nonprofit that does extensive outreach work at Mass and Cass. Excuse me. Criminalization of drug use and harassment of outreach workers does nothing to move people toward recovery and creates additional barriers to housing that just increases the chances of a fatal overdose. Excuse me. More police engagement would be a marked shift from the approach known as harm reduction, which seeks to make drug use safer without demanding abstinence or changes in behavior. Sorry about that. For years, Boston and other cities expanded needle exchange programs and encouraged groups to hand out over-the-counter overdose reversal nasal sprays and safer drug use supplies to people on the streets. While the programs have been widely credited for helping to reduce drug overdoses, they are increasingly coming under attack for encouraging illicit drug use. Local governments in cities such as Houston, Philadelphia, and San Francisco are retreating from the approach and emphasizing more enforcement. We are trying to fundamentally shift our approach from one that allows people to keep using drugs and sharing needles again and again and again. Sorry. Shifting to one where they have to enter some level of treatment. Neighborhood groups such as the South End Forum have pointed to the city statistics to suggest ramped up enforcement efforts are working. Since September, Boston's coordinated response team has moved 480 people from Mass and Cass to substance use treatment, according to Kelly Young, head of the team. The city has also expanded access to low-threshold housing, which provides support services and has fewer prerequisites for entry. The proposals would extend those efforts while adding several new initiatives. That includes... Oh, my goodness. That includes the creation of specialty recovery court. Excuse me for all that coughing. That would steer people arrested on drug charges away from the traditional criminal process and instead guide them into treatment and long-term recovery. They also called for an expansion of specialized police teams trained on moving people off the streets and into treatment. The teams of case managers who have themselves battled through addiction can help people through the recovery process. Proponents say that the goal is to not lose track of people by creating a seamless continuum of care, from the streets to detox to long-term treatment, with criminal justice system serving as a support, not a centerpiece. What we're saying is you cannot continue to use drugs on the street. That's a fundamental principle, said Sue Sullivan, executive director of the New Market Business Improvement District, which hires people who are homeless and in recovery to clean up Mass and Cass area. Through this initiative, hundreds, if not thousands, will have a chance at addiction, mental, and physical health treatment and care. The multi-pronged strategy has gained backing from certain addiction specialists and members of the recovery community who turned out in large numbers for a media event Wednesday in the South End. Among them was Melissa Baker, 45, of Dorchester, a former cocaine and heroin user who 4 years ago was living in a tent at Mass and Cass. She described her time at the intersection as the worst and lowest experience of my life, marked by daily fights and frequent overdoses. Ms. Baker said that she might not be alive were it not for the intervention of a city outreach team, which persuaded her to go to a detox facility and then help her find supportive housing. Melissa Baker cautioned that short-term measures such as ramping up arrests or forcing people into detox cannot replace or sustain a coordinated approach. It's not enough just to send someone to detox. You have to be there for that person, Melissa Baker said, because a lot of people on Mass and Cass are alone. They do not have anyone, and they leave the detox and go straight back to the streets. But if you have even one person there to support you and push you, like they did with me, then you can get your life back on track. Sounds hopeful. Also on our front page, Local police caught in the middle of ice. Authority unclear in dealing with federal agents, by Leah Skeen of the Globe staff. The directives from local leaders were clear, laid out in an executive orders. Immigration agents are largely banned from municipal property, and first responders have the duty to document potential misconduct involving federal agents. But already some law enforcement leaders are expressing concern about whether the orders are asking too much of the local police. It's the latest source of frustration from municipal law enforcement agencies as the Trump administration immigration crackdown poses new challenges for officers who often find themselves caught between the federal government and the residents that they pledged to protect and serve. Leaders of Boston and five nearby cities announced that the executive orders early this month, seeking to limit the authority of immigration and custom enforcement officials amid President Trump's mass deportation agenda. The directives could endanger local police, creating conflict with several agents and compelling them to make a split-second legal determinations within a highly volatile, fast-paced environment. Medford Police Chief Jack Buckley wrote in a letter to the members of the Massachusetts Mayor, City Chiefs of Police, and municipal leaders in their communities. Forcing such real-time legal analysis creates an operational paralysis that endangers the public, the federal agents, and our own personnel, wrote Buckley, president of the group. Across the country, law enforcement leaders have complained about ICE agents engaging in egregious and unprofessional behavior that goes against standard training and police best practices, including smashing car windows and forcibly entering people's homes without a judicial warrant, pepper spraying peaceful protesters, and using other aggressive crowd control tactics. In Minneapolis, Minnesota, escalating confrontations between federal agents and protesters led to the deadly shooting of two civilians. During an immigration enforcement operation in Maine last month, Cumberland County Sheriff Kevin Joyce condemned ICE tactics after agents detained a local correction officer with a valid work authorization and no criminal history. The agents left the man's car unsecured and unattended following his arrest, which Joyce calls Bush League policing. Federal officials, however, have defended the approach. U.S. Attorney Leah B. Foley has repeatedly warned against interfering with President Trump's administration's immigration efforts. During a recent roundtable with reporters, U.S. Attorney Leah Foley said that federal agents are expected to follow federal law, not state law, which she said is inapplicable to them. Unveiled by officials from Boston, Cambridge, Somerville, Lynn, Newton, and Chelsea, the executive orders prohibit immigration agents from using city property as a staging area for their planned enforcement actions. They also direct local police officers to de-escalate potential confrontations and immediately render medical aid when needed. Much of their language mirrors actions taken in other cities, including Chicago and Minneapolis. The orders make clear to our residents and workforce that Boston is focused on keeping people safe, a city spokesperson said in a statement. In face of the reckless and even dangerous actions from the federal government, we will act to de-escalate, document any violations, and ensure safety for our residents, first responders, and our entire workforce, she said in a statement. The mayor's office did not comment directly. It remains unclear how Boston plans to enforce its orders beyond potentially suing the federal government over the alleged violations. Local officials have provided scant details about what happens if ICE refuses to comply. Mayor Michelle Wu, who spearheaded the effort, said that during the during an appearance on Boston Public Radio that people should not expect to see Boston police officers arresting ICE agents. This is not to provoke conflict between multiple armed officers of different levels of the government, she said. Rather, local police will be there to document the violations of laws happening, to record with body-worn cameras, and to use official police reports, to release all that information for future legal accountability, she said. The order states repeatedly that it does not require or permit obstructions of federal immigration enforcement. It encourages residents to call 911 to report warrantless entry into homes and businesses. Boston police shall investigate all violence, property damage, and allegations of criminal conduct, including by federal officials, and appropriately document such incidents, according to the order. The case should be referred to the prosecutors when appropriate, the order states. Asking officers to investigate immigration enforcement operations places them in an untenable position of appearing to obstruct federal law, a conflict that has historically been resolved in the favor of the federal preemption, wrote Jack Buckley, whose organization includes police leaders from six participating cities. It is essentially marks a reversal in law enforcement oversight, and said Chuck Wexler, executive director of the Boston Executive Research Forum for Police, a Washington-based think tank. More often, federal agencies are called upon to investigate reports of misconduct at the local level, such as civil rights violations. It is a sign of the times. We are living in uncharted waters, Wexler said, and it has not been the role historically that local law enforcement would be responsible for monitoring federal law enforcement. So, from a practical standpoint, it's a challenging responsibility. Tom Nolan, a former Boston police lieutenant and criminologist, said the city leaders should issue additional guidance to their local public safety agencies. While he supports the mayor's political message, Nolan said it's probably not a stretch to think that the President Trump's administration could view it as a provocation and descend on the city. I do share concerns about how this plays out at the street level or at the station. What direction should a supervisor give his subordinate officers? ICE agents are routinely engaging in illegal behavior, Nolan said. Those would be considered felonies if they were committed by the average citizen on the street in Massachusetts. Do we call it what it is, or do we call it something else because it's a federal agent that has committed the offense? Larry Calderon, president of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, said that the union would welcome guidance from the department leadership about how to enforce the orders. As always, members of the BP, Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, will continue to enforce all laws, rules, and regulations of the Boston Police Department and all orders put forth by the Boston Police Commissioner, Michael Cox, said in a statement. Others said local government leaders should consider further action to check problematic immigration enforcement offices in and around Boston. Joshua Denkoff, director of the Strategic Initiatives for Boston-based nonprofit Citizens for Juvenile Justice, said he'd like to see more limitations on information sharing between the Boston Police Department and ICE. He argued that there is room to expand on the city's Trust Act, which bans Boston police from detaining immigrants solely on the basis of federal civil immigration detainer. Still, the executive order presents a meaningful opportunity for local law enforcement officers to really make clear that their property is to protect their priority is to protect the people here, not collude with immigration officials. It is uncomfortable, but if our police are going to protect us, then they should do so against all threats, including threats posed by our federal government right now. It pains me to say that this is certainly unprecedented times. So it is. Next we have A2. The EPA faces lawsuit over its killing of major climate rule. Groups called finding illegal, by Karen Zarek of the New York Times. Washington. The first shots have been fired in the legal war over the Environmental Protection Agency, a Democratic agency state's boost-owned rollback efforts to address climate change. Environmental health and health groups filed on Wednesday morning in U.S. District Court of Appeals and the District of Columbia Circuit Court, arguing that the EPA's move to eliminate limits on greenhouse gases from vehicles and potentially other sources was illegal. The suit was triggered last week by a decision that the EPA to kill one of its key scientific conclusions, the endangerment finding, which says that greenhouse gases harm public health. The finding has formed the basis for climate regulations in the United States. The lawsuit claims that the agency is rehashing arguments that the Supreme Court already considered and rejected in the landmark 2007 case, Massachusetts versus the EPA. The issue is likely to end up back before the Supreme Court, which is now far more conservative. In the 2007 case, the justices ruled that the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, was required to issue a scientific determination as to whether greenhouse gases were a threat to the public health under the 1970 Clean Air Act, and to regulate them if they were. As a result, 2 years later, in 2009, the EPA issued an endangerment filing allowing the government to limit greenhouse gas emissions, which causes climate change. With this action, the EPA flips its mission on its head, said Hannah Viscara, a senior lawyer at the nonprofit Earth Justice Group, which represents six groups in the lawsuit. It abandons its core mandate to protect human health and the environment to boosting polluting industries and attempts to rewrite the law in order to do so. There was some debate about the escalating legal fight to the United States Supreme Court, given its ideological orientation. But William Permatel, the managing director of the Environmental Law Program at the University of Maryland, Francis King Carey School of Law, said in an interview that environmentalists must challenge this. If they don't, then you are agreeing that we should not regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. Full stop. Permatel said that, I do not think any environmentalists, I think the majority of the public does not agree with the statement at all. If the environmentalists and the Democrats and Democratic states that have vowed to file suits similarly lose, the onus would be on Congress to pass the national law to regulate greenhouse gases. The idea that Congress should act was one of the arguments that the EPA made in its final ruling on the finding announced at the White House on Thursday by Agency Administrator Lee Zeldin and President Trump. Lee Zeldin has said that since 2007, two different Supreme Court decisions have changed the legal calculus and endangerment findings. One ruling found Congress must weigh in on the major questions that have significant political and economic implications, as the EPA rules do. Another found that the courts do not have to show so much deference to the decisions of federal agencies. Meredith Hankins, legal director for federal climate at the Natural Resources Defense Council, said the U.S. EPA's slapdash legal argument should be laughed out of court. The plaintiffs, 17 in total, also include the Sierra Club and American Public Health Association. Bridget Hirsch, press secretary for the EPA, said Wednesday that the agency was committed to following the law exactly as it is written, and Congress intended, not as others might wish it to be. The agency said it has concluded that the Clean Air Act did not provide it with a legal authority to set vehicle emission standards for greenhouse gases. In the absence of such authority, the endangerment finding is not valid. The EPA cannot retain the regulations that resulted from it. States are expected to jump into legal action soon. Governor Gavin Newsom of California has vowed to sue and is likely to be joined by other Democratic governors. Next on our editorial page. Here's an editorial. Massachusetts needs a statewide water plan, following right up with the EPA. New Salem is a small rural town of 1,000 people located along the banks of the Quabbin Reservoir, the water source that supplies many eastern Massachusetts towns through the Massachusetts Water Resources Authority. Ironically, New Salem struggles with its own water infrastructure. There is no municipal water supply, so buildings rely on private wells. Well, when the well serving the town administrator's building ran dry, she had to buy bottled drinking water and use a bathroom across the street. New Salem Board of Selectmen Chair Susan Cloutier told an editorial board that piping water throughout the town is physically infeasible. Given the hilly, spread-out nature of the community, Cloutier said, there could be a way to build a municipal water supply into the town center where residents could go get drinking water if their well went dry or became contaminated. But that would take money in a town with an annual budget of about $3.5 million and where many town officials are volunteers. A group of Quabbin watershed towns are pushing for legislation to create a trust fund financed by the MWRA communities to pay towns that border the Quabbin. It is creating a financial solution that seems duplicative, since the state already compensates those communities. But the effort points to a real need. Many communities in Massachusetts lack reliable water source. Worse, there is no statewide plan to figure out how to help them. Before Massachusetts' water problems worsen, the State Water Resources Commission should embark on a creation of a statewide water plan. Planning could explore what it would take to provide every region with reliable water and could be used to prioritize where the state should spend its money. A big part of this would probably be looking at which communities should be supported to join the Massachusetts Water Resources Authority, which is the state's most reliable water source. There is a need to be a statewide, comprehensive, strategic look to be taken at a future of, for the future of water and how it's allocated and where the supply is going to and coming from and the strategies to manage that in the coming decades, said David McGlinchey, Executive Director of the Massachusetts River Alliances. The Massachusetts Water Resources Authority provides a clean source of water for 61 member communities in eastern and central Massachusetts. Joining can be expensive, so members have generally been those communities with resources to afford it. Other regions struggle to reliably access water. The MWRA conducted 4 expansion studies over the past few years, examining what it would take to provide water to communities in the Metro West area, the Ipswich River Basin, the South Shore, and most recently the Quabbin Reservoir watershed communities. There are myriad reasons why these communities could use the water. Some Quabbin communities lack any municipal water. The Ipswich River Basin is considered stressed, meaning that there is not enough water to meet the demand, so towns often face water restrictions like limiting lawn irrigation. The South Shore faces similar supply issues. Communities have water contaminated by PFAS, chemicals that can cause health risks, and they must spend money treating the water. The lack of water constrains development. Weymouth, for example, considering joining the MWRA as part of a plan to redevelop the former South Weymouth Naval Air Station, since Weymouth's current water sources cannot meet the demand for envisioned 4,000 new units and 10 million square feet of commercial space. But the MWRA does not have the capacity to do all those expansions, and the cost of expanding could be prohibitive. Particularly for smaller communities, for example, the Quabbin area study found that the cost of bringing Quabbin water to New Salem and three other towns would cost $215.4 million in 2024, while the new groundwater sources to serve New Salem and its neighbors would cost $112.4 million. Expanding water to the South Shore could cost up to $1.25 billion in 2022 dollars to cover 10 communities. The project in the Ipswich River Basin and Metro West could cost anywhere from $110 million to $1.1 billion, depending on how many communities are served. As McGlinchey put it, when you have these different options in front of you, it's impossible to prioritize and to know which one should receive devoted resources, because we have not taken this overarching view and assessment of water needs and supplies and resources. In 2024, House Speaker Ron Marino tried to obtain $1 billion earmarked in a housing bill to expand the Massachusetts Water Resources Authority access to communities he represents in the Ipswich River Basin and the South Shore. The earmark never made it into law, but the attempt to make it clear that if the state does not prioritize where it puts finite MWRA resources based on priorities like environmental need, economic development strategy, or cost effectiveness, those decisions may be made instead based on which communities have political power. Addressing water supply will look different in different towns. New Salem may need money for a municipal well in the village center. Hooking up a few South Shore or Ipswich River Basin communities to the MWRA might provide additional capacity needed in existing water supplies to serve the remaining towns. Some towns could get a more reliable supply with an investment in water treatment equipment. A statewide plan determining what needs to be done and where would help ensure that the greatest number of communities can obtain access to clean, reliable water in the most cost-effective way. Should be a good plan to follow. Okay. Moving on. Moving on to business, Hiawatha Bray Tech Lab. I grew up watching sci-fi movies about cyborgs. Last week, I got to be one. A cyborg, of course, is what you get when you bolt electronic hardware onto a human body to make it capable of things it couldn't do before. Think RoboCop or the $6 million man or me, says Hiawatha Bray. I've been testing Hypershell X, it's Hypershell, capital X, Ultra, Ultra, a remarkable device that uses robotic hardware to boost the power of his legs for greater speed and endurance, designed for hikers and mountain bikers. It also has shown some promise as a way to help people with disabilities. Hypershell belongs to a family of products called exoskeletons, named after armored bodies of lobsters and beetles. These devices strap onto our bodies to deliver greater strength and endurance. They range from passive devices made of complex fabrics to battery-powered systems that wrap around the body like Sigourney Weaver's space forklift from Aliens. And the companies around the world are developing them for a host of tasks. Exosuits help U.S. warehouse workers lift heavy loads. In Germany, healthcare workers don exosuits to help them lift patients from hospital beds. And in China and in the United States, they are both developing exosuits for soldiers to let them march faster with heavier loads of food and ammunition. Continuing on. Hiawatha Bray borrowed a couple of exoskeletons from the exoskeleton store, which claims to be the only retailer of its kind in the United States. And it is in the last place you'd look. Not Silicon Valley or Cambridge, but in Alexandria, Minnesota, a town of 15,000 located between Minneapolis and Fargo, North Dakota. There's nothing robotic about one of the products I tried. Though Swiss-made OxyVio lift suit, instead, it uses elastic straps that capture the body's energy when you bend over to grab an object and gives the energy back as you lift it. Not exactly Iron Man, but it comes in handy when clearing the snow from my driveway. I thought I'd consider hanging the lift suit in my garage next to my favorite shovel until I saw the price, $1,700. More than a good snowblower. Still, it's cheaper than the doctor bills for a wrenched back, which is why factories and warehouses buy lift suits for their workers. For a robotic conversion of the same concept, you could look to Verve Motion, a Cambridge company founded by researchers at Harvard University. The company's Safe Lift exosuit, which Hiawatha Bray did not try out personally, uses motion detection chips to monitor body movements. When the user bends forward to lift something, an electric motor tightens up the straps on the back of the vest to help pull the worker upright. It's supposed to handle about 40% of the weight being lifted. So when a worker lifts a 50-pound box, his muscles are only lifting 30 pounds. That's hundreds of pounds less effort per worker every working day. On the downside, SafeLift could offer a new way to spy on workers. The suit monitors every lift, feeding the statistics into a tracking system. Now the bosses will know exactly how long it takes you to empty a truckload of anvils, which team members didn't try too hard. Verve Motion co-founder Ignacio Galeana says that the system isn't intended for this purpose, but I figure it's bound to be used that way. Still, having spent part of my youth unloading mail trucks, I am sure plenty of workers will have happily strapped on SafeLift. Verve Motion exosuit doesn't come cheap, but then the company doesn't sell them. Instead, it leases them. Customers such as Stop and Shop and UPS pay around $350 a month per suit. In all, very practical. But when you think about exoskeleton, I do not think practical. I think Iron Man. I want something that will give me superpowers. So, of course, I had to try it out. The Hypershell X Ultra, described by its Chinese manufacturers as the world's best outdoor exoskeleton to date. The Hypershell is a titanium frame that wraps around your waist and with straps that wrap around your thighs just above the knees. Two electric motors on either side align with your hips and connect to a carbon filter rods that are attached to the thigh straps. Each motor is roughly the size of a hockey puck and produces about 1.3 horsepower. The smartphone app controls power output. You can set it for a gentle assist when hiking or a big boost when running or climbing stairs. Start walking and onboard motor sensing chips like the ones in our phones instantly detect the movement and activate the motors. As you walk, the leg motors tug your thighs upward, extending your stride. Your muscles will still provide about 80% of the energy used in walking, but the Hypershell does the rest. It's not enough to make you a superhero, but when I ran flat out on my power-assisted legs with the theme for music for The Avengers blasting through my headphones, it was the most fun I've ever had on a treadmill. Hypershell says it sold about 20,000 units worldwide, mainly to sort of people who wear "This Person Climbed Mount Washington" t-shirts. The company insists it is not intended for medical use, perhaps to avoid scrutiny from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Still, it has been a godsend for Nicole Miller of the Deer River, Minnesota, and her 14-year-old daughter, Avery. Last August, Avery was diagnosed with bradykinesia, a neurological disorder that makes walking extremely difficult. With the help from a walker, Avery could cover only about 100 yards before becoming exhausted. The first few months were horrible. Desperate for a solution, her family found on the internet, came across the Hypershell. She knew was a medical device, but figured it wasn't a medical device, but figured there was nothing to lose. Avery put that on and she walked for an hour, Miller said. I have not seen her upright like that in nearly 4 months. Now Avery really takes it off. It's absolutely awesome. It's weird that it isn't supposed to be for my condition, but it's amazing that it works so well for me. Verve Motion creator and Harvard engineering professor Connor Walsh has been working on a medical-grade exoskeleton for years. He's developing one specifically to help people with mobility problems. Connor Walsh intends to launch a new company to manufacture them. Robots look and function like humans are still years away from everyday use. But robots that attach to our bodies and help us to become more capable and maybe more human are right around the corner. Sounds like something I'd like to try. Okay, and of course, Metro, today there is a sports story, and sports, of course, with the Olympics is taking flight, as it says here, taking flight at Vermont's Olympic size ski jump by Jessica Rinaldi of the Globe staff. Brattleboro, Vermont. In 1922, a college kid named Fred Harris built a wooden ski jump in his hometown of Brattleboro, and the Harris Hill ski jump was born. This past weekend, 55 ski jumpers took part in the 104th Harris Hill Ski Jump Competition, and they came from as far away as Norway and Slovenia to compete on the only Olympic-sized ski jump in New England. According to organizers, nearly 6,000 people came out to watch, and the jumpers flew down the ramp and glided through the air. The athletes are judged not only on distance, but also on style, with judges looking at three parts of their jump, their formation while they are in flight, their landing in the telemark position with one ski in front of the other, knees bent, and how well they maintain their form after they've touched down on the outrun at the end of their jump. This year's competition, which concluded with the Olympic, coincided with the Olympic Winter Olympics in Milan, saw 17-year-old Henry Loher from Lake Placid, New York, edge out Slovenia's Rosa. Rosa had been on track to permanently retire the trophy after winning the open class championships for the past 2 years in a row. But Loher, second jump of 99 meters, which is 325 feet, gave him a total score of 252.5 to best Rosa's 250. The first ever women's open class trophy was awarded to Slovenia's Nezeka Rapine with a 91.5 meter jump, 300 feet jump, putting her ahead of other competitors. So, I'm going to move, of course, onto some sports, because there's a lot of it. And the men's hockey, Mighty Quinn scores a U.S. win. Hughes, a goal in overtime, secures a spot in the semis by Matt Porter of the Globe staff. United States 2, Sweden 1. Quinn Hughes became an American hero Wednesday, and the Americans are one win away from the gold medal game. The defenseman danced into the offensive zone, and his wrister beat Team Sweden goalie Jacob Markstrom in 3 minutes and 27 seconds into overtime, giving the United States a 2-1 win and a date with the Slovakia in the Olympic semifinals Friday, tomorrow. The Team USA semifinal will be played at 3:10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and the first semifinals at the Santa Guila Arena will be between Canada and Finland at 10:40 a.m. Quinn Hughes spent a load of his ice time game, 27 minutes and 31 seconds, controlling the puck. He played nearly two-thirds of the overtime and factored in both the U.S. goals, picking up a secondary assist on the first, a skillful Dylan Larkin deflection of a point shot from his brother, Jack Hughes. Unbelievable moment for our country and for the USA hockey, Larkin said. For him to do it, it gives me chills. Unbelievable performance out of him. Quinn Hughes was injured and missed last February 4th's Nations faceoff. Americans are thrilled to have him back. He's incredibly a blue line partner, Jolly McAvoy of the Bruins said. With his skating, his stick handling, he is able to create something out of nothing there and win us that hockey game kind all by itself. Also on the sports page front is women's hockey. Olympic stage spotlights growth of women's game by Kate McInerney of the Globe staff. Milan. The stakes have never been higher for women's hockey than they will be on Thursday. The United States and Canada will be playing for the gold medal, something the rivals have done six times of seven times this final has been played at the Olympics. But this year it's different, in a large part because what the players will return to in North America after the closing ceremony. The event of a professional women's hockey league now in the middle of its third season and has been a revelation for women, the women's game. These are the first Olympics where players will go back to a league that offers actual resources, livable salaries, and a collective bargaining agreement, training facilities and staff, games with fans in the stands, since the women's tournament was introduced in 1998. Also on the front page is a gilded run. In her final race of the games, Michaela Schifrin silences doubters with a dominant victory in the slalom by John Powers on Olympics. It has been 8 years since Michaela Schifrin stood on the Olympic podium, 8 years of build-up and letdown, 8 years since she felt a medal around her neck. This was her last chance at these games, and at 30, perhaps the last of her career. This is a moment I've been pretty scared of for a long time, the planet's greatest skier confessed. Michaela Schifrin had come up empty in five individual starts with three did-not finishes in Beijing in 2022. She already missed twice in Cortina. Wednesday's slalom was the last opportunity left to her, and Michaela Schifrin grabbed it with both hands, delivering performances for the ages with a monster run that produced the biggest winning margin, 1.5 seconds, in nearly four decades. Even more than that, Schifrin's dominant triumph was capstone of a career that began with her slalom gold in Sochi when she was just 18 in 2014, and it erased the baffling memories of a lost fortnight on the Chinese mountain. I felt every range of emotion in the last 3 months, in the last 4 months, in the last 4 years, in the last 8 years, Michaela Schifrin said. There's so many different journeys I've been on just to be here now. There was the death of her father in a home accident in 2020, and there was the gruesome injury that she suffered at Killington, Vermont last season when she punctured her abdomen in a crash. Running on, page C5. If anything, the weight of expectation has increased since her Beijing bust when Schifrin said, I felt like I was a joke. She's been having a wondrous season on the World Cup circuit, winning 7 of 8 slalom races and putting herself on top of the chase for the overall crown. So, when she came in 15th in the slalom leg of the team combined, costing herself and downhiller Breezy Johnson what appeared to be a gimme gold, that whispers began again. The Olympic wobblies had come back. She cannot handle the pressure anymore. The whispers increased when she came in 11th in last week's giant slalom, the race in which she won gold in 2018. But Shiffrin was in a good place in her head. The slalom has always been her best event, the one that has produced 71 of her record. 108 cup victories and 4 world titles. She gave up the speed races to focus on it. During the last few days, Michaela Shiffrin reminded herself to get back to the essence of what she does and has always done. Honestly, the skiing is what I care about, Shiffrin said. Of course, a medal and a gold, that's a dream come true. But at some point this week, I just said, like, stop dreaming, just ski. The morning came up bright and blue in the Dolomites with a near idle snow conditions, ideal snow conditions. A high tempo ripper, Shiffrin was told. So she attacked the first run. She shook off a nicked gait and put up a time of 47.13 seconds and put her head by more than 0.8 of a second. I was like, okay, the gold is gone, conceded Camille Rast, the Swiss world champion and the only rival to beat Michaela Shiffrin this season. Nobody figured to eclipse that time in the second run. Shiffrin, who smiled and gave thumbs up while she was perched in the leader's chair, knew that. She took a nap before the finale, ate her customary nerves-calming sour gummy, and went to the start. Just before her, Germany's Lena Dürer, who had been sitting second, hooked the first gate and skied out. Michaela Shiffrin had been there in Beijing and left it behind her. Go clean and rip this thing, she heard on her team's radio. You've got it. So she attacked right out of the gate, picking up speed along the way and nearly doubled her advantage in what was the largest differential since Switzerland's Vreni Schneider won in 1988 in Calgary. Michaela Schifrin's whopping margin was bigger than those of the last 6 games combined. In another league, she said Sweden's Anna Swin Larsson, who took the bronze home behind Ross. After she crossed the line, Michaela Shiffrin squatted over her skis to comprehend what she had done. Really hard to understand and process, she said. Coming down that last and besting the field was how Michaela Shiffrin claimed her first gold in 2014 when she became the youngest Olympian slalom victor in history. Maybe just today I realized what has happened in Sochi, she mused. It's all crazy. Observers predicting that day that Shiffrin might become the greatest ever to twist her way down the slopes, and she did. What she wanted at her fourth game was to provide an exclamation point, and she did that too. It's like being born again, she said, and she declared. Also, Vermonter second to Klebo's 10th gold. Ogden grabs another silver. This is on the notebook page of the Winter Olympics. Fresh off ending a 50-year medal drought in the men's cross-country skiing, Vermont's Ben Ogden proved Wednesday that it was no fluke by winning his second silver. Teaming up with Gus Schumacher, the U.S. men's event gave runway favor for its Norway some real competition and held off host country Italy's in the home stretch for its winningest Olympics ever at the Milan Cortina Games. We just proved today and all week that we're here to stay and that the U.S. guys are in good form, Ogden said. So it was so awesome. Ogden became the first American man to win the cross-country skiing medal in the Olympics in 50 years when he won the silver in the sprint event on February 10th until Bill Koch, an Ogden family friend who won the silver in 1976 in Innsbruck, was the sole American man to win the medal in the sport. The win in the men's team sprint makes Ogden America's most decorated male cross-country skier. The two-man relay involved 2 legs by each skier, with Ogden starting the race and Schumacher closing. That meant Schumacher was competing head-to-head with Norway's Johannes Holst Klebo, who who has dominated the sport and keeps setting new Olympic records. Claybaugh's win Wednesday was his 10th gold medal, breaking his own record for the most overall golds in the Winter Olympics. And that continues. It concludes, I think, this weekend, and this concludes the reading of the Boston Globe on a sunny day. Hope you enjoy.